This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear an excerpt from talks at the Breck Forum by citizen soldiers Todd Ensign and our own Michael Smith. They'll talk about how anti-war GIs remain pivotal to the movement's success. There are several significant events surrounding the U.S. policy on torture taking place this week. In that vein, we'll bring you a speech from Professor Al McCoy, author of A Question of Torture. At this year's Left Forum, Professor McCoy spoke on a panel titled Torture and the Decline of the American Empire. Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Go now to hear an excerpt from speeches at the Brecht Forum by our own Michael Smith and citizen soldiers Todd Ensign. The anti-war soldier panel started with Michael Smith describing his work defending anti-war GIs at Fort Jackson, South Carolina, and the formation of the GI Civil Liberties Defense Committee. We also hear from Todd Ensign with citizen soldier. Todd is a co-coordinator of the Different Drummer Cafe at Fort Drum, a meeting place for soldiers who often get immediately deployed to battle after training at Fort Drum. Anti-war GIs were pivotal to the movement's success. The growing protests from within the U.S. military today echo the Vietnam War soldiers' experience. The panel discusses the role of anti-war GI organizing in the anti-war movements from the 1960s to the present. Let's have a listen.
If I was over in Vietnam as a second lieutenant in the infantry, I wouldn't be talking to you today. Those people were as expendable as fruit flies. And instead, I was free. So I get out of college, and they had deferments for law school. So I thought, I'll go to law school. Can't hurt. I didn't know what else to do. And I started going to law school, and I got active in the anti-war movement, first defending GIs that were active, and then I got another deferment. When my student deferment for law school ran up, I got another deferment. I applied to the Domestic Peace Corps. It was called VISTA. But instead of sending you overseas to some third world country, they sent me to Detroit, which was like, well, Todd's smiling because he's from Detroit too. Detroit had pockets that were third world. It was kind of an oppression internally in America. It's a very, very radical place, Detroit. I was quite lucky because I got my education in Detroit. I started hanging around Eugene V. Debs Hall. They had socialist forums every Friday night. They had a terrific bookstore. They had books by Debs. I learned about the First World War. I met socialists, and I got an orientation from them about what you do with respect to GIs. That these are our brothers and sisters, and you try to help them out. And if you're going to be drafted into the Army, the position that the people in the Socialist Workers Party had, who I met, was you write a letter to the Army and you say, you want me? You can have me. But I want you to know that when I get in there, I'm not going to give up any of my rights as a citizen soldier. I have a right to vote. I have a right to inform myself of who to vote for. I got a right to have literature, to read books, to talk to people, to demonstrate. I'm a citizen soldier. So if you want me, you got me. But you understand, when I get into the Army, I'm going to be organizing against the war in Vietnam. And that was the position that the Socialist Workers Party took in those days, and that's what its members did. So this leads me to Fort Jackson and what we did at Fort Jackson. We had two comrades at Fort Jackson, and we met with Leonard Boudin, who was the dean of constitutional lawyers in those days. He was the great civil liberties, civil rights lawyer in the United States. And we met with him, the leaders of the SWP, and we said, you know, we're going to start organizing down in Fort Jackson. The soldiers down there want to start organizing, and we've got to devise a strategy to protect them and defend them. And the strategy they came up with was this, that as citizen soldiers, you can petition your government, right? You can discuss issues with people. You can sign a petition. So they started circulating a petition to General James Hollingsworth, the general who was head of Fort Jackson. And the petition said, General, we want to meet here on the base. We want you to give us space where we can sit and talk with our fellow GIs, because we want to make our views about this war known to our representatives in Congress. And they started circulating this petition around the base and signing people up for GIs United Against the War. They started, initially, it was an all-black group of GIs from New York, mainly. The leader of it was a guy named Joe Miles, who was later transferred to Fort Bragg. That was a mistake because he organized a group up there. There was another young man named Tommy Woodfin, 20 years old. Woodfin had attended a lot of speeches at the Audubon Ballroom, listened to Malcolm X. He was a real militant. He thought, you know, they could teach me some things in this Army. So when the deal goes down in the United States, I'll be trained. So I want to go into the Army and pick some lessons up. There was another fella named Andy Pulley. Pulley was from Cleveland. He was 17 years old when I first met him. He organized a walkout from his high school in Cleveland on Martin Luther King's birthday. And he got arrested for it. And the judge told him, I'm going to either put you in a juvenile detention camp or you can sign up for the Army. So that's how he got into the Army. There was another absolutely wonderful young man named Jose Rutter. Jose Rutter was a Puerto Rican kid. He was an orphan. He was adopted by two people in the Communist Party who lived in Washington, D.C. He was kind of a rebellious kid, and he was kind of on the rebound from his parents, and he had been falsely accused of stealing a wallet. Kind of in defiance of the whole scene, he joined the Army, and they sent him to Vietnam as a sniper. And here's his story. He won a Silver Star and a Purple Heart. He was a great soldier. One day he was out in the field. Fire came down from a tree. He dropped to the ground, then he returned the fire up in the tree. Body fell out of the tree. He ran over to see who he had killed, and it was a 16-year-old Vietnamese girl. He took his rifle and he threw it down. Captain came over to him and said, pick up that rifle. And Rutter said, no. He was court-martialed, sent back to the United States, sent to Fort Jackson. They were going to retrain him as a supply guy. And the last guy who was a leader of the Fort Jackson 8 was a white guy from Atlanta named Joe Cole. 24 years old, he was the oldest in the group. Most of them were 17 or 18. Cole had been in the YSA, the youth group of the Socialist Workers Party. He was a congenial, lanky, southern guy, real likable, real smart, and a really good organizer. So it was those four that put the group together. They went from playing Malcolm X tapes in the barracks to other black and Puerto Rican soldiers to opening up the group. They decided they would call themselves GIs United, meaning they'd bring in whites as well. United against the war, united against racism in the Army. The first meeting they had when they brought in whites into the organization had 80 people to it. The second meeting they had, which got them all arrested, was one hot spring night. Jose Rutter yelled up to the barracks. He was out on the lawn in uniform, and he yelled up, all you guys that are against the war in Vietnam, listen to me, I got something to say. 100 people came to that meeting. The brass stood around, they didn't know what to do. They told Andrew Pulley to tuck in his shirt. They told somebody else to do this. They couldn't stop it, they just observed it, and the next day they arrested all the leaders of it. that's where I got involved. I was a lawyer in Detroit at the time. We formed the GI Civil Liberties Defense Committee. We had a two-pronged strategy to defend these people. It's a strategy that we learned from the IWW. It's a strategy that's as valid today as it ever was, and that's this, that you give people first-class representation in the courtroom, but don't make a mistake of thinking that you're going to get any justice in the courtroom. That you also have to shine the light of public opinion on these people, and you've got to get as much publicity as possible. So as the honorary chairman of the GI Civil Liberties Defense Committee, we got Bertrand Russell, who was the great English philosopher in those days. Pete Seeger signed on as a member of the Defense Committee. We got famous people. We got non-famous people. We got thousands of people. We circulated petitions around the country. We got press from all over the place. When they started the Article 32 hearing, which is kind of preliminary hearing before a court-martial, we had our lawyers down there. We had the press corps down there. We had Robert Sherrill came down. He was the correspondent for The Nation. He wrote a lead article in The Nation. Ben Franklin came down from the New York Times. He wrote an article, and this is what broke it. He wrote an article in the Sunday Times. It was on the front page of the Sunday Times, and it started off with a quote from Clemenceau, the French politician. And Clemenceau famously said, "Military music is to music as military justice is to justice." That was the name of Sherrill's book. Chapter in Sherrill's book was about this. Anyway, the army got so much bad publicity over persecuting these guys for doing what? Behaving as citizens, even though they were soldiers, that the army dropped the case. They also, and I'm going to conclude with this point, they also revised the Department of Defense directives on how soldiers can conduct themselves in the army. And they said, soldiers can have all the anti-war literature they want. They got a right to it. They can demonstrate in the big demonstrations. They can't wear uniforms, but if they want to go out and demonstrate against the war, they got a right to do that. They got a right to talk to each other unimpeded, you know, and so on and so on. That, along with several other cases, which I don't have time to talk about, was really the turning point, because we demonstrated to the movement in America that GIs were our allies. They weren't contemptible mercenaries that you should spit on. Just the opposite. And if we could win them over, we could help stop the war. We stopped the war for several reasons. One was the strength of the Vietnamese. That was the first main reason that the Vietnamese held out, even though 3 million of them were killed. They held out. They didn't knuckle under. And we stopped the war because of the tremendous sentiment in the United States against the war. And we stopped the war because GIs are really an extension of the civilian population, if you think about it. They're somebody's son or daughter, they're somebody's brother, they're somebody's friend. When you organize civilians against the war, you're kind of ipso facto organizing GIs as well. And so we were able to organize a tremendous anti-war movement here, independent of the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. A movement that had 500,000 people in the streets in Washington. The price was just too high for Nixon to pay, and they withdrew troops from Vietnam. And that was the lesson we learned from organizing, and that's the kind of thing that we're not quite able to do yet today, but that's the topic that Todd's going to address. So thank you very much for your attention.
I wrote a book about 3-4 years ago called America's Military Today, and basically what I'm trying to do in here is explain how the military has changed. And it's been an enormous amount of change, and it's important if you want to even think about these movements and issues, you really need to have a better understanding. The principal thing Michael alluded to, and that is that we no longer have conscription. And as Michael said, the draft was important, but there in Vietnam, for example, 1/3 of the Vietnam fighters on our soldiers were draftees. Another third were what were called draft-induced volunteers, another third. And the last third were volunteers. They're people at all times that will join the military for opportunity or family tradition or that. So the draft and the presence of draftees and draft-induced volunteers was very central to what was the composition of the military at that time. And today, as you know, we do not have a draft. And from what I can see with both parties and with Barack Obama, not a word about spreading this burden not a word about the fact that the military in a democracy should represent the society. These aren't issues that anyone really wants to talk about. And I would predict that as long as we can continue to pay, and you're talking now $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 bonuses paid cash on the barrelhead for soldiers to stay in or to join initially, as long as they can meet their numbers, they just met their May numbers, is an email I got yesterday, as long as the economic state, the state that Michael's talking about, Michigan's lost 200,000 industrial jobs in the last 8 years. Those are jobs with pensions, jobs with health care, jobs with union wages. So that's throughout the country, and that's, of course, why they've been able to create a mercenary force, and they're able to maintain it. And as long as they can do that, we'll never see a return to a draft. And that's a complicated issue, which I discussed. The one thing you need to understand is that in 73, there was a commission set up under the leadership of Milton Friedman, the Nobel laureate, very conservative economist from the University of Chicago. And on that commission were people like, surprise, Donald Rumsfeld. Hey, Dick Cheney. Really? Gee. And these people sat down and decided, how can we have a military which is no longer relying on the conscription method? And it wasn't that hard to figure out. Raise the pay to competitive levels, which they've done. Two, involve Guard and Reserve in every mobilization, which we're doing. Guard and Reserve people over at Lexington and 25th Street are training all the time to be sent to Iraq and Afghanistan and all over this country. Third, involve women. Before, in Vietnam and before, women played roles as nurses and clericals. That was it. Today, 20% of the Air Force is female. 16% of the Navy is female. The Marines and the Army have lower levels because they have these combat jobs for which women are still excluded. But the point is, women play a central role. You go on any Army base today, you'll see women all over the place playing commanding roles in the military. So those are big changes that have occurred. I'm not arguing against that. I'm just saying that those are the way they've been able to do this. And Milton Friedman's famous line was, he said, I believe that the majority of sentiment against the war in Vietnam is fueled by the draft. And you look out here today, Mike was saying, for example, when Nixon invaded Cambodia, a totally illegal invasion in 1970, those of us at the time remember, over 300 university and college campuses were shut down for weeks, because the students realized what was next. And they took action. And I'm not talking just about Harvard and Ann Arbor and University of Michigan. I'm talking about schools like SUNY Buffalo. I happened to be there at that time. That campus was shut down for 3 weeks because students, and you know, sometimes these conservative pundits, they talk about selfish this or that's, there's nothing wrong with acting in self-interest. That's not somehow cowardly or un-American. So young people said, I don't want to go there and fight that war. And I did exactly the same thing that Michael did. I wasn't all that wild about lawyering or lawyers, but I thought, damn, better to be here than over there. And you didn't pay any price. You didn't pay any price. And I even came here to NYU and did a master's degree in law, which gave me the little time that I needed to get me past 26, which was the deal. Our presidents did that. That's a lot of people did. And some people said, well, the draft wasn't really fair anyway. That's true. There were many ways to escape it. Bill Clinton, George Bush, you name them. But the fact is the draft did levy the military weight upon the society in a very different way than today. And so I'm going to bring it up to today at Fort Drum. So we went up to Fort Drum for a couple of reasons. One, because it's reasonably close. It's the only base left in the Northeast. There are no other bases, literally. And it's you wouldn't realize it maybe from here, but it's a very important base because it's totally mobilized around training for counterinsurgency wars. And counterinsurgency covers a multitude of things, as you probably know. And so the brigades at Drum, there's very little, the military has a term called tooth to tail. You can get the idea, you get the image. There's very little tail up at Fort Drum. You don't see people sitting around, you know, in rooms running computers. You don't see people in the back sorting laundry. No. Everyone up there just about is a soldier, a combat soldier. And they go and they deploy. And so what we found up there is they have the highest rate of deployment. We've got a brigade. We've got three brigades up there. Another one's coming in. We got a brigade going out in September. Many people in that brigade are on their third or fourth tour. Tours now have been extended, in some cases, to 15 months. So some of those people have already done 45 months in a combat zone. And then remember the nature of the war there. Even Vietnam, there was some wiggle room. Guys would go into Saigon. People would get leave. Actually go to Hong Kong for a few days. People, in other words, the pressure was there for sure, but it was not like it is in Iraq. In Iraq, it's never ending. In this, you can't. The green zone isn't safe, obviously, and the soldiers aren't allowed in the green zone anyway. So it's a constant 24-hour-a-day girding, and kind of it's an enormous producer of PTSD, is what it is, because one of the keynotes to post-traumatic stress disorder is hyperarousal. Hyperarousal comes from intense fear, and any of us in this room, we were placed in that setting in Iraq, we would be hyper aroused, I guarantee you. And so that's what's happening with these soldiers, is they are doing tour after tour. That we're making demands on way beyond what's done in Vietnam, in my opinion, and I think it's true. And the PTSD rates, you know, are climbing. Suicide rates are climbing. We've got alcoholism and drug abuse up there that's rampant. So we have a commanding general up there. You may have heard, this was in the Times a while ago. And he said, well, we got to get at this problem of all these drinking soldiers. So we're going to run their photos, color photos of them, in the base newspaper every week with details about them, how they were arrested, what they were doing. They were false. They were asleep and drunk on the floor of their car, that kind of thing. Now, these are people that have only been accused, for one thing. I know lawyers always talk about due process, but, you know, due process is important, actually. So they've been accused. Some of them will be acquitted. Some of them will win on appeal for evidentiary reasons. And what happens to them? Okay, and so, but the worst thing about it is the general was asked by a couple of reporters, he said, well, why do you do this? I mean, is there any evidence that you can deter drinking by this kind of exposure and humiliation? And the answer, of course, is no, there isn't any evidence. And he said, well, what I know is two things. It's getting worse. Drunk driving does create terrible victims of it. We've got to do something. And of course, a compassionate answer would be, well, you need to expand the mental health services and programs that would allow people to go somewhere and get some assistance with the terrible things they're self-medicating against, like sleeplessness, terrible nightmares, suicidal ideation, all that stuff. And he has not a clue to this. It's actually shocking. And yet, this is the atmosphere at that base. They have. There's another thing that most people don't realize is that much of military medicine now has been privatized. You know about Blackwater, right? You know about KBR. You know about Halliburton, of course. At Fort Drum, there's no hospital. It's shocking. 18,000 combat troops and 12,000 dependents. No hospital. I'm not kidding. There's a hospital in town. There's a contract, privatization contract between the hospital and the base. So if a soldier is freaking out or is suicidal, they must take them all the way to the fort, to Watertown's Samaritan Hospital. There's 26 beds there, and we've had cases where guys have come in there, there's no place to put them. No place to put them. And they end up driving them all the way to the VA in Syracuse, which is 65 miles away. So, I tell you, we opened the project, I thought, my God, we've got to, the traction here is just obvious because of the way people are suffering, families. And I don't bring, I'm not going to bring you a song or a statement of great optimism. What we see is that people endure. One of the reasons is that for many of these people, this is the best job they've ever had. And a lot of people, I think, in the peace movement have trouble understanding that. Well, how could it be a good job? But it is a good job. They're making, I always say, it's better than a night window at Wendy's. And that's what these folks have been doing. They have high school, maybe a GED. They have no training. They're from states like Michigan or Ohio where there's no longer any union training anyway. There's no apprenticeships of any kind. The unions have been weakened to the point of being busted, really, in my opinion. And so they come in there and their families are living better. They have, they've built enormous base housing. Fort Drum's an enormous base, 105,000 acres, vast place. They're building. It just looks like looks like Southern California in the 60s, what it looks like. And this is a place where they have so far been able to pacify or make quiescent the mass of troops. And so what we're trying to do, trying at the different drummer, is to see if we can link up with soldiers around some really important issues, not necessarily around the war. Although when you talk to a soldier, you find, when we first moved there, I thought we had big windows on the side of our cafe. They were just there. And I said, oh, gee, I don't know about these windows. I'm a little worried. You know what? And the soldiers have told us this. We don't have to worry about the windows. The soldiers think the war sucks. They hate the war. They don't necessarily share our views of the sources of the war or all that, but they do know the war is not being fought in an effective way. They think Bush and KBR and those other people are blood-sucking liars. Many GIs, that the word war for oil will roll off their tongues whenever you talk to them. So it's not a problem of us saying the war is wrong or it's bad, the troops should be at home. It's that we haven't yet been able to connect up in a way that puts those bodies in the street. I never forget, you've probably seen the film Sir, No Sir, the documentary, have you? It's worth seeing if you haven't. And in that documentary, there's a scene at Fort Hood, Texas, where over 1,000 GIs from Fort Hood marched through the streets of Killeen, Texas on a Saturday with banners that said, bring us home, immediate withdrawal. Over 1,000 soldiers from the base. To me, that was the high watermark, or one of them, of the GI movement. That was a very dynamic and exciting thing. We're a long way from that, but what we have been able to do is lock into some of the issues like post-traumatic stress. The fact is not much help or any help sometimes for these guys and for their families. And so we've had forums on PTSD. We'll get a good turnout for those. We'll get a good turnout for the punk rock bands we have in the weekends. And we try then to, you know, do literature distributions and have programs on Saturdays that will involve people. But as Michael indicated earlier, you're talking about a period where the anti-war movement, the big tent of the anti-war movement, is changed. And I remember at Fort, I was at Camp Lejeune on a case back in the 70s, and the soldiers there had a coffee house there at Camp Lejeune. This is Marines. And they said they couldn't keep the Eldridge Cleaver and Huey Newton books in stock, because so many black Marines would come in looking for them and wanting to read them, or Malcolm X tapes, that stuff. And so that tells you something about that period, that African Americans were struggling moving forward. You had a burgeoning women's movement, you had a civil rights movement, and you had, and Michael didn't really allude to this much, but you had a labor movement. You had a progressive labor movement, which is today much weakened, if not. You know, and so those movements built those GI, those anti-war forces, and then those anti-war forces. It was very common then, you go to a coffee house, there were over 20 of them. You go to one, and you meet people that work in there, and you'd say, oh, how'd you get here? There were soldiers, of course, but there were civilians, because you have to have some people there all the time. And so the civilians would come, and they would say, well, I just graduated, and I want to give a year to this. And they would sleep in the basement of the house or whatever it was. They'd eat, you know, big pots of chili and stew and stuff. And it was a sense of being part of something. It was very exciting. And in that same film I'm telling you about, you look, they pan around the room of the Oleo Strut, which is where Fort Hood was. That was where the coffee house was. And on the walls you see the posters. And you know what they were, most of them? Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, Bob Dylan. Believe it or not, in one corner there's a poster of Che Guevara, which sort of surprised me. And the point was, the coffee house was seen as part of that alternative opening up liberating movement. And that, if people would come there, the GIs would put their tie-dye shirts on. They'd wear pipes and, you know, hookahs and stuff around their necks. And it was a whole way of connecting with a large youth movement, alternative movement, call it what you will, which was enormous. And again, we don't have that today, certainly in the form that it existed then. But we are working with some other projects. There's one at Fort Hood now. Some soldiers, IBAW members, are trying to get it going. We work with people at Fort Lewis, trying to help them. But as I say, you have the underlying reality of people that are married. Over half of the ones that are married have children. Those are conserving tendencies in people's lives. They're not free to just go out and join something, or maybe be identified with their to the detriment of their careers, that sort of thing. And further, you have people that if they leave there and they are drummed out, they really are going, they aren't going back to the auto plant. They're not going back to the steel mill. Those things are all gone. And so it's history moves on, and we're in a different period, and we have to try to struggle with all this. And to conclude, I find it very exciting up there. And we have a small group. We have about 15 soldiers that really come around. They're really part of our work that we try to pass as much as we can of the leadership to them so that they formulate and articulate what they want to see. Like, for example, a while ago, this is sort of prosaic, but they said, you know, we need a pool table in here. We want to come down at night and just shoot pool. We don't want to just always be, you know, having anti-war stuff. And so we went out and we found a real nice pool table, and we have it in the different drummer. Now, guys come in and shoot pool. That's an example of something. We have a big soda machine we put in because guys just want to come in and get a soda. And so it's, and we've gotten support. Citizen Soldiers supported by members. We have about 7,000 people. In the last couple of years, people have really been increasing their support for us, sending in, instead of $50, they'll send $100. People really see what we're trying to do and how important it is. But it's a struggle, and it absolutely requires an understanding that we're dealing with a wholly different military today. And that's the thought I'll leave you with. There's also a pamphlet I brought. This is a very interesting pamphlet. It was written after the Vietnam War by a guy named Matt Rinaldi, who was at the Shelter Half Coffee House in Port Louis, one of the successful coffee houses. And it's a very interesting critique of the problems when civilians start mixing with soldiers and you're trying to set agendas and work. And this is very very illustrative of the problems then and today. So that's what I'll finish with.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. There are several significant events surrounding the U.S. policy on torture taking place this week. Already last week, the United States Senate Committee on Armed Services held hearings on the origins of aggressive interrogation techniques. Among the events this week is the fifth session of the United Nations Committee Against Torture, Subcommittee on Prevention of Torture, and Other Cruel, Inhuman, or Degrading Treatment or Punishment in Geneva. And Amnesty International releases a report on torture and unfair trials in Tunisia's war on terror. Amnesty International's Guantanamo prison cell replica opens to the public in Washington, D.C. through Sunday, June 29th. And there's also the World Day in Support of Victims of Torture. Today we bring you a speech by Professor Al McCoy, author of A Question of Torture. The panel was recorded at this year's Left Forum. It was titled Torture and the Decline of the American Empire and moderated by our own Michael Stephen Smith. Let's have a listen.
This afternoon, I will discuss a short history of psychological torture. This will be a lecture in four parts that describes the 50-year history of CIA psychological torture. The four parts are discovery, propagation, perfection, and legalization. Part one. Discovery. On April 28, 2004, as we all know, Americans were stunned when CBS television broadcast those now notorious photographs from Abu Ghraib showing hooded Iraqis stripped naked while U.S. soldiers stood by smiling. As this scandal grabbed headlines around the globe, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld insisted that the abuses were perpetrated by, quote, a small number of U.S. military, whom the conservative New York Times columnist William Sapphire soon branded as creeps. These photos are not, however, snapshots of simple brutality or a breakdown in military discipline. For example, that most iconic of all those photos showing an Iraqi hooded with fake electrical wires hanging from his extended arm shows not the sadism of a few creeps, but instead the two key trademarks of the CIA's psychological torture paradigm. The hood is for sensory deprivation, the arms are extended for self-inflicted pain. It is that simple, it is that obvious. Sadly, the Abu Ghraib scandal, conditions at Guantanamo, and their severe blow to America's international standing make it important for us to discuss the sordid topic of torture, particularly that most persistent, most problematic, and most distinctively American form of torture, psychological torture. Viewed historically, the Abu Ghraib scandal is the product of a deeply contradictory U.S. policy towards torture since the start of the Cold War. Publicly, at the United Nations and other international fora, Washington opposed torture and advocated a universal standard of human rights. Simultaneously and secretly, however, the CIA propagated ingenious new torture techniques in contravention of those same international conventions. From 1950 to 1962, the CIA led a secret research effort to crack the code of human consciousness, a veritable Manhattan Project of the mind, with costs that reached at peak in the late 1950s of $1 billion a year. Now, if we trace a narrative thread through a maze of hundreds of experiments, this massive mind control research moved through two distinct phases. First, an in-house CIA exploration of exotic techniques such as hypnosis and hallucinogenic drugs like LSD, and a later focus on more mundane behavioral experimentation subcontracted to some of the most brilliant scientists of their generation. While the agency drug testing led to nowhere except lawsuits, CIA-funded behavioral experiments outsourced to the country's leading universities, Harvard, Princeton, Yale, and others, produced two key findings that contributed to the discovery of psychological torture, perhaps best described as no-touch torture. Discovery number one, sensory deprivation. In the early 1950s, famed Canadian psychologist Dr. Donald O. Hebb found that he could induce a state akin to psychosis in just 24 hours. Now, what had the doctor done? Drugs? Hypnosis? Electroshock? No, none of the above. For 2 days, student volunteers at McGill University, where Dr. Hebb was chair of psychology, simply sat in a comfortable air-conditioned cubicle, deprived of sensory stimulation by goggles, gloves, and earmuffs. One of Dr. Hebb's subjects, the now retired University of California English professor, Peter Dale Scott, was a subject in those experiments as an undergraduate at McGill, and he described the hallucinogenic impact of isolation in his 1992 epic poem titled Listening to the Candle. Let me read a few stanzas to give you a sense of that experience. My ears soar from their earphones, amniotic hum my eyes, under two bulging halves of ping pong balls, arms covered to the tips with cardboard tubes, those familiar hallucinations I was the first to report, as for example, the string of cutout paper men emerging from a manhole in the side of a snow white hill, distinctly two dimensional. For 2 days they paid my mind to withdraw itself from every impulse but its own, to look only on itself, not seeing objects as objects. Dr. Hebb himself reported that after 2 to 3 days of such isolation from stimulus, quote, the subject's very identity had begun to disintegrate. Discovery number two, self-inflicted pain. During the 1950s as well, two eminent neurologists at Cornell University Medical Center, working for the CIA under contract here in New York City, found that the KGB's most devastating torture technique involved not crude physical beatings, but instead simply forcing the victim to stand for days at a time while the legs swelled, the skin erupted in suppurating lesions, the kidneys shut down, and hallucinations began. In 1963, after a decade of this secret mind control research, the CIA codified its findings in a succinct secret interrogation handbook, the QBARC Counterintelligence Interrogation Manual, which would become the basis for a new method of torture, psychological torture, disseminated worldwide over the next three decades. If you want to read the manual for yourself, just go to Google and type in K-U-B-A-R-K, and in a nanosecond, you've got a facsimile on your screen. If genius is the discovery of the obvious, then the CIA's development of this no-touch torture was a counterintuitive breakthrough, the first real revolution in the cruel science of pain in centuries. Through more than 2,000 years of Western judicial torture, the same problem persisted. The strong defied pain, and the weak blurted out whatever was necessary to stop it. In the 3rd century AD, when torture of witnesses was a requisite of Roman law, the jurist Ulpian called torture a delicate, dangerous, and deceptive thing. Everything we have learned about torture in the past 1,800 years can be summarized in Ulpian's pithy 3rd century axiom. Quote, "For many persons have such strength of body and soul that they heed pain very little, so there is no means of obtaining the truth from them, while others are so susceptible to pain that they will tell any lie rather than suffer it," end quote. By contrast, the CIA's psychological paradigm fused these two new methods, sensory disorientation and self-inflicted pain, whose combination would, in theory, cause victims to feel responsible for their own suffering and thus capitulate more readily to their torturers. Refined through years of practice, the CIA's use of sensory disorientation relies on a mix of sensory overload and sensory deprivation via seemingly banal, even benign techniques: heat and cold, light and dark, noise and silence, isolation, then intense interrogation for a systematic attack on all human stimuli. In its clandestine journey across continents and decades, this distinctly American form of psychological torture would prove elusive, resilient, adaptable, powerfully seductive, and devastatingly destructive, attributes that have allowed it to persist to the present and may well allow it to persist into the future. Let's review each attribute briefly. First, elusive. Unlike its physical variant, psychological torture lacks clear signs of abuse and thus easily eludes detection, greatly complicating any investigation, prosecution, or attempt at prohibition. Resilient. Psychological torture is shrouded in a scientific patina that appeals to policymakers and avoids the obvious physical brutality unpalatable to the American public. Adaptable. In 40 years since its discovery, the agency's psychological paradigm has proved surprisingly adaptable, with each sustained application producing important innovations. We'll see more of that later. Seductive. For both the perpetrators and the powerful who command them, torture has, I suspect, a darkly erotic appeal. Even when torture is initially intended for a few Soviet spies or a few top Al-Qaeda commanders, it soon spreads uncontrollably in two directions: rapid proliferation of the torture of the many and an inexorable escalation in the scale of brutality. So seductive is torture's appeal to the powerful that they will always concoct rationales to preserve their prerogative of torture in defiance of all evidence of ineffectiveness in interrogation and all evidence of its enormously high political cost. Destructive. Although seemingly less brutal than physical methods, the CIA's no-touch torture actually leaves searing psychological scars. Victims often need long treatment to recover from a trauma that many experts consider more crippling than physical pain. Part two, propagation of the paradigm. After codification of the 1963 Kubark Manual, the CIA spent the next 30 years propagating these torture techniques within the US intelligence community and among anti-communist allies across Asia and Latin America. After the CIA applied these techniques in South Vietnam under the Phoenix Program, whose methods became brutally physical, causing 40,000 deaths from extrajudicial execution, these methods were transmitted to Latin America under the US Army's Project X from 1966 to 1991, a full quarter century. In a 1983 training manual, for example, the CIA taught Honduran military interrogators that they should, quote, "manipulate the subject's environment to create intolerable situations to disrupt patterns of time, space, and sensory perception," end quote. In short, a total assault on the sensory pathways to to the existential platform of human identity. These techniques in this 1983 manual seem strikingly similar to those outlined 20 years earlier in the Kubark manual and those that would be used 20 years later at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. Part 3, perfection of psychological torture. When the Cold War came to a close, Washington resumed its advocacy of human rights, ratifying the UN Convention Against Torture in 1994 that banned the infliction of severe psychological and physical pain. On the surface, the United States had apparently resolved the tension between its anti-torture principles and its torture practices. Yet when President Clinton sent this UN Convention to Congress for its ratification in 1994, he included a language drafted 6 years earlier by the conservative Reagan administration containing 4 detailed paragraphs of diplomatic reservations focused on just one word in the 26 printed pages of that UN anti-torture convention. That word was mental. Significantly, these intricately constructed diplomatic reservations redefined torture for the United States to exclude sensory deprivation and self-inflicted pain, the very techniques that the CIA had developed at such cost in previous decades. This definition was reproduced verbatim in domestic legislation enacted to give legal force to the UN Convention. First, and most importantly, in Section 2340 of the US Federal Code. Now, if you were undergraduates in my lecture courses at University of Wisconsin, when I say, remember Section 2340, you'd close your laptops, you'd stop passing notes, you'd snap out of your daydream, and you'd write it down because it would be on the midterm. And I would have your undivided attention for that nanosecond before you drifted back to other more important activities. I don't have that coercive capacity here today. So all I can do is just ask you, snap out of your daydreams, remember Section 2340, because it's very important. And we'll be coming back to it at the end. In effect,
18 U.S.C.
18 U.S.C., thank you. In effect, somebody knows. Washington had split the U.N. Convention down the middle, banning physical torture, but exempting psychological abuse from that same ban. By failing to repudiate the CIA's use of torture while adopting a U.N. Convention that condemned its practice, the United States left this contradiction buried like a political landmine ready to detonate with such phenomenal force just 10 years later in the Abu Ghraib prison scandal. Right after his public address to a shaken nation on September 11, 2001, President Bush, here you go, Michael, your parrot's ready. Bring your parrot? We could use your parrot right now. Gave his White House staff secret orders saying, quote, "I don't care what the international lawyers say, we are going to kick some ass," end quote. In this spirit, the White House allowed the CIA, in the aftermath of 9/11, 10 enhanced interrogation methods designed by agency psychologists, including waterboarding, a particularly cruel method that replicates drowning. This technique, which was called torturae gallicae ordinariae, or standard Gallic torture in the 1541 French judicial handbook, would now become what CIA Director Porter Goss called in 2005, quote, "a professional interrogation technique." After French paratroopers tortured him with this technique during the Battle for Algiers in 1957, French journalist Henri Allègre wrote a moving description of this method in a book that turned France against torture and the Algerian War. Let me quote, "I tried by contracting my throat to take in as little water as possible and to resist suffocation by keeping air in my lungs for as long as I could. But I couldn't hold on for more than a few moments. I had the impression of drowning, and a terrible agony, that of death itself, took possession of me," end quote. Let's think a little bit about the deeper meaning of Allègre's sparse words, "a terrible agony, that of death itself." Although written years before science discovered this cognitive reflex, Allègre's work were an eerily active summary of the mammalian diving reflex, a deep-seated fear of drowning hardwired into human physiology and psychology in ways that allows human infants to survive underwater for up to 20 minutes without dying and without brain damage. Under waterboarding, as water blocks the air to the lungs, the human organism's powerful mammalian diving reflex kicks in and the brain is racked by horrifically painful signals. Death, 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 death. Then the victim vomits out the water, the lungs suck in air, the panic subsides, and it happens again and again and again, each time inscribing the searing trauma of near death in human memory and producing one of the most extreme forms of pain imaginable, even unimaginable. In late 2002, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld appointed General Jeffrey Miller to command Guantanamo with a wide latitude for interrogation, making this prison into an ad hoc behavioral science laboratory for the perfection of the CIA's torture paradigm. Under General Miller, Guantanamo's interrogators stiffened the psychological assault beyond human sensory receptors, the old paradigm, by exploring Arab cultural sensitivity to sexuality, gender identity, and dogs. General Miller also formed so-called behavioral science consultation teams of military psychologists who probed each detainee for individual fears and phobias, such as fear of dark or attachment to mother. Through this total three-phase attack on human sensory receptors, cultural identity, and individual psyche, Guantanamo perfected the CIA's psychological torture paradigm. Significantly, after regular inspections of Guantanamo from 2002 to 2004, the International Red Cross reported, and I quote, "The construction of such a system cannot be considered other than an intentional system of cruel, unusual, and degrading treatment and a form of torture." And a form of torture. After a visit from Guantanamo Chief General Miller in August and September 2003, the U.S. Commander for Iraq, General Ricardo Sanchez, issued orders for sophisticated psychological torture. Now, as I read from these orders, which are again available on the internet, please listen for the combination of these three fundamental techniques which are key to the psychological paradigm: sensory disorientation, self-inflicted pain, and that recent intervention, cultural humiliation. U, environmental manipulation, altering the environment to create moderate discomfort, e.g. adjusting temperatures or introducing an unpleasant smell. V, sleep adjustment, adjusting the sleeping times of the detainee, e.g. reversing the sleeping cycles from night to day. Isolation, isolating the detainee from other detainees for 30 days. Presence of military working dogs exploits Arab fear of dogs while maintaining security. AA, yelling, loud music, and light control, used to create fear, disorient detainee, and prolong capture shock. CC, stress positions, use of physical posturing, sitting, standing, kneeling, prone. Indeed, my review of the 2,000 still classified Abu Ghraib photos on the CD in the possession of the Army's criminal investigation campaign reveals not random, perverse, idiosyncratic acts from separate sadistic minds, but instead just three psychological torture techniques repeated over and over ad nauseum: hooding for sensory deprivation, short shackling, long shackling, and forced standing for self-inflicted pain, and total nudity for sexual humiliation, and dogs for that recent innovation, exploitation of Arab cultural sensitivity. It is no accident that Private Linda England was famously photographed leading an Iraqi detainee leashed like a dog. Part 4, legalization of psychological torture. Confronted by anger over detainee abuse at Abu Ghraib, the Bush White House has fought back by defending torture as a presidential prerogative necessary to fight the war on terror. But in June 2006, in a dramatic rebuke, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Hamdan v. Rumsfeld that Bush's military commissions were illegal because they did not meet the requirement under the Geneva Conventions that Guantanamo detainees be tried with, quote, all the judicial guarantees recognized as indispensable by civilized peoples. Then on September 6, 2006, in a dramatic bid to legalize his now illegal policies, in the aftermath of this Hamdan decision, President Bush announced he was transferring 14 top al-Qaeda captives from CIA secret prisons to Guantanamo Bay. To allow this CIA program to go forward, President Bush announced that he was sending legislation to Congress that would legalize the same presidential prerogatives in treatment of detainees challenged by the Supreme Court. After a day-long negotiations in Vice President Cheney's Senate office in September 2006, Republican partisans reached a compromise that sailed through Congress within a week, and without any amendment, this legislation became the Military Commissions Act 2006. Most significantly, by using verbatim the narrow definition of severe mental pain that the United States first adopted back in 1994. This law allows the CIA interrogators ample latitude for future psychological torture.
That was Professor Al McCoy, author of A Question of Torture, speaking at this year's Left Forum on a panel titled Torture and the Decline of the American Empire. Several radio stations around the country have started to carry Law and Disorder. We'd like to acknowledge these stations. WHYS, Eau Claire Community Radio, 96.3 FM, Eau Claire, Wisconsin. KRFP Radio Free Moscow, 92.5 FM, Moscow, Idaho. WFRN Nashville, Tennessee, Radio Free Nashville, 98.9 FM. KSOW Cottage Grove, Oregon, 106.7 FM. WYAP Clay, West Virginia, 101.7 FM. KRFC Fort Collins, Colorado. WRCT 88.3 FM, Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
And two stations in Alaska, KWMD 90.7 in Kasilof, Radio Anchorage at 104.5 FM in Anchorage, Alaska. WXOJ LP 103.3 FM in Northampton, Massachusetts. KIF FM 100.4 FM in Enid, Oklahoma. 1640 AM station in Front Royal, Virginia. Moton Community House Radio Online, and ISPCA Radio, that's the Indiana Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, broadcasting worldwide from Indiana. And last, from Asheville, North Carolina, WPVM 103.5 FM, the progressive voice of the mountains.
Thanks to all of our affiliates.
And their listeners.